Thank you very much. That should be halfway suitable. So it's a pleasure to thank the organizers, in particular David Hobson and Vicky Henderson, for inviting me to give a talk here. I am going to present work about pricing portfolio credit derivatives in a Markovian model with default interaction, and that is joint work with Jochen Backhaus. He's a PhD student of mine in Leipzig. Originally, I'd hoped to talk about something else which would be better related to the previous talks, but as it happens, our research didn't quite, we had some slight problems, so I decided it's better to speak about credit risk. Now, as you all know, portfolio credit derivatives or credit derivatives are securities whose payoff is contingent on credit events in a given firm, or in case of portfolio credit derivatives, in a pool of firms. And that's what we're going to be interested in. And we're going to be interested in particular in pricing portfolio credit derivatives in a Markovian model, which is sort of different from the standard Gauss-Kopler model, which is mainly used by practitioners. And this Gauss-Kopler model is sort of a bit ad hoc. And so we thought it would be interesting to look at models which have a different structure to compare them. And in the end, we also see some terms of some benefits of this different approach, in the sense that we can explain market prices a bit better than the standard model can. In that sense, there is sort of an obvious link to the previous talk by Eliot Giermann. So what I'm going to talk about, introduction, we're in the midst of that. Then I'm going to introduce our model. Then I'm going to talk about pricing basket default swaps, and in particular CDOs in that model. The talk is based on a working paper of mine and Jochen. And if you want to learn more about background information, you could see the following. I couldn't resist to do a little bit of propaganda. And our book on quantitative risk management, which has been authored by Alexander McNeil, Paul Embrecht from Zurich, and myself, which is going to appear this November, I think, in the Princeton series in finance. I've seen it's even in the leaflets outside. And there, amongst others, you find a lot about copulas and credit risk models and these things. I like the picture. Good. So what type of a very brief introduction? So as I said, I want to look at a model which is an alternative to the market standard. So it might be a good idea to start with a very brief overview of the models which are there. The first class of models for credit portfolios are models with conditionally independent defaults. You have some stochastic process for default intensity in a portfolio, say a Coxinger-Soros process or a Coxinger-Soros process with jumps, and then given this process, firms are independent. It's still a useful modeling approach. Then you have copula models. This is the first one by Lee in the famous papers by Schönbucher and Schubert and others. They have become market standard. The main reason for that is because that they are on the one hand simple, and on the other hand very easy to calibrate to a given term structure of single firm credit swap spreads. That is sort of built in automatically. The drawback is that the dependence between defaults is sort of, well, you impose it by a choice of a copula and you don't derive it from some more fundamental quantities if you want. There's a special case of so-called factor copula models, which have at least an intuitive economic interpretation in terms of incomplete models. Then there is a number of papers on common shock models, where you can have common shocks which cause more than one default at the same time. That is a popular modeling in the actuarial sciences, where a shock could be, for instance, the windstorm, and that causes then losses in several business lines, whatever, several types of insurance. And this is the attempt to carry this type of modeling over to credit risks. And then there are models with interacting intensities, which are going to be the focus of this talk. A little basic concept and mainly notation, which will be enforced throughout the talk. We'll always consider M firms with default times tau I and the default indicator process. That should be capital YT, that's YT of 1 up to YT of M, and YT of I is just the indicator that default has happened, so that is the process which jumps from 0 to 1 at the default time. Fi bar is going to be the survival function of an individual firm. The joint survival function is going to be F bar of T1 up to Tm, the probability that all these firms are still alive. Very often we need order default times, T0, capital T0, T1, and so forth. So that T0 is typically 0, T1 is the time the first default happens, the second, and so forth. And then, of course, we need to know which firm defaulted at this capital TI, and that is going to be modeled by this random variable psi n. That is the identity of the firm which defaults at time tn. So if you want cap tn, psi n would be like the marked point process representation of this default history. Filtrations, credit risk depends very, modeling depends very much on information, and so we need filtrations. HTI is the filtration generated by the default observation of firm I. HT is the filtration generated by default information of all firms in the portfolio, or the internal filtration of our default indicator process. And if you work, but we don't do that much, of course, sometimes you have an extra background process, and that would be then added. Default intensities, an adapted process, lambda TI is called default intensity with respect to this information HT. It's the default indicator minus the integral from 0 to tau I minimum T lambda S I ds. Is an HT martingale, that's why HT. And sometimes one has to be a little bit careful here, because it does make a difference if you have an HT or an HTI in here for certain models. Default intensities determine basically everything you want to know about these processes, in particular they determine the law of the default indicator process. Okay, so I need to talk a little bit about coupler models, because I want to refer to them later on. And they are the market standard. A little bit of background. A coupler is a distribution function in 0, 1 with uniform margins. So I will simply have to tell you the missing letter here, always. And they do describe the dependent structure of a multivariate distribution with distribution function f. The most important application of couplers is if f itself has continuous margins, and if you then have a random vector x distributed according to f, then the coupler of this x is the distribution of f1 of x1 up to fm of xn. So by doing the probability transform, we sort of get them all on a make these all uniforms. If you want, we put this distribution on a common scale where we can compare them. You've sort of taken the marginal information out of the distribution, and the remaining part, the distribution function on the unit cube, can then be thought as a representation of the dependent structure of the distribution. And that is the coupler, and you have the following relation between the multivariate distribution function f and its coupler. F of x1 up to xm is the coupler applied to the individual marginal distributions. A similar thing holds for survival functions, which is a little bit more natural in the credit risk context. The survival function can be written as f bar of x1 up to xm is another coupler applied to the individual survival functions, and c hat is obtained from c by reflection at the point 1/2, 1/2, 1/2, like given you C hat of U1 up to UM is the original one at evaluated 1 minus to U1 up to 1 minus UM. And if this one here is a symmetric one, then survival coupler and the other ordinary coupler are the same. As an example, the Gauss coupler is the coupler of a random vector X which has a standard normal distribution with mean 0 and correlation matrix P. You could take another mean and a full covariance matrix, but by standardizing them, the coupler remains the same. And that is an important coupler which is used in credit risk. So coupler models in credit risk, that's the only slide I'm really going to have about that. They are specified in terms of the marginal distributions of default times. So in the simplest case, you could think of an exponential distribution with a given parameter giving you the time up to default for each firm. And this parameter could be determined, for instance, from credit default swaps. And then, of course, you have to join them to get a multivariate distribution of your default times. And that is done using coupler. And because we're going to only work with survival copulas, we're going to denote them by C instead of C hat from now on. So the survival function will be of this form. F bar of T1 up to Tm will be C of F1 bar of T1 up to Fm bar of Tm. What's the main advantage of specifying this model in this two-step procedure instead of specifying this here all at once? This is related to the way these models are being calibrated. Typically, these marginal distributions, as I just said, would be calibrated to credit swap spreads or something, credit default swap spreads. And so they are sort of given, and the market practitioners would want any model they are using to be capable to reproduce these prices immediately. In this way, this is sort of automatically ensured, and then in a second stage, one would calibrate the parameters of this coupler in order to embed one's views on default correlation or maybe prices of portfolio credit products into the procedure. And the example which is sort of used as main reference model, and which is a little bit the same as the same status as the Black-Scholes model maybe has on equity options markets, is the exchangeable Gauss coupler model. There you would simply start with a random variable X, which has a simple factor structure. Xi is the square root of some correlation parameter rho times a common factor V plus 1 minus square root of 1 minus rho epsilon I. And these here are typical factor models, V and epsilon I, IID standard normals. So this X would be a normal vector, and of course the higher the rho is, the more they move together. If you then do a probability transform and put ui equal to phi of xi, then this vector u follows the standard Gaussian copula, and you would then define the survival function doing this recipe here, bearing in mind that c is the distribution function of u, so you get f bar of t1 up to tm is the probability that u1 is smaller than f1 bar, and so forth. And if you wanted more explicit, you would apply the inverse of the standard normal distribution and get your Gaussian vector here and here. So that's the Gaussian copula. It has basically this one parameter to model the overall dependence. Just bear that in mind as a reference for later. Now we're going to come to an alternative modeling approach, models with interacting intensities. And there the idea is that we model default dependence or default contagion. Contagion means the reaction of the conditional survival of the default intensity or survival distribution of one obligor given the news that another obligor defaulted. And then we're going to model that explicitly. We model the default intensity as a function of time and the state of the portfolio. For instance, if you assume that, say, if a default has happened, that is sort of bad news for the other firms, we would say as soon as we have a first one in this state vector, the intensity of the other ones would go up. And you can extend that to stochastic state variables as well. The advantage, you have a relatively intuitive and explicit parametrization of default dependence, and you can study this model, for instance, using Markov process or Markov chain techniques. The disadvantage, and we are currently working on that a little bit, the calibration to term structure of defaultable bonds is more difficult because the marginal distribution is not available, typically not available in closed form, and if you want to evaluate it, you cannot evaluate the marginal distribution of sort of a one firm individual of what the others are doing. A few comments on related work. First paper doing this type of modeling is Davis and Lowe. They have good Markov chain ideas. Another very famous paper by Jarrow and Yu, they also introduced this interaction between intensities, but due to the mathematics they employ, they could have only a very special type of interaction. Mathematical aspects have been studied by Kuzuoka and in the book of Biletki-Rutkowski. Pricing, theoretical arguments for pricing can be found, for instance, in this paper by Colin Dufresne, Goldstein and Tugunier, where they introduce the survival measure, and there's a technique which applies also in the framework of these models. These papers contain sort of an interesting link to statistical physics and interacting particle systems, and that's a recent master thesis from Sweden where also similar ideas are pursued. There are a few more. Now, how to construct these models? You would construct them via Markov chains. We have a time S equal to 0, 1 to the M is the state space of our portfolio, where we record the default state of every firm at time T. And so we view it, our portfolio indicator as Markov chain on that space, and that can then jump from one state, one element of the state space to another one, which of course sort of models defaults. And the transition intensity to go from state Y to state X is of the following form. If Yi, the ith element of Y, is zero, so if firm I is alive at time t, then the chain can jump from Y to the state X, which is YI. YI simply means that you flip the I-th coordinate. So in this state, YI from I is default, whereas in this state, Y from I is not default. And the intensity with which that happens is this lambda I of T and Y. And that's the only type of transitions possible. You can jump only to neighboring states where exactly one firm or is default. And the intensity with of that happening is just this lambda I. So that's the interpretation. The chain can jump to neighboring states by which differ by exactly one default. And the probability of that happening is in a small t, t plus h is approximately equal to h times lambda I of t and yt. And so that sort of gives you intuitively that this lambda I should be the default intensity, which is of course true by the Dinkin formula. Useful concept in studying the model is the generator of the chain given here. So that's the transition intensities, and you jump from y to the state yi. We know that yi of t minus this here is a martingale by the Dinkin formula, so that this construction gives us in fact the default intensities we want. Another useful tool, the transition intensities of the chain are given by the probability that starting at time t in state x, at time s bigger than t, I'm going to end up in y, and they can be characterized by the, for instance, by a set of ODEs, the Kolmogorov equations. That's the only remaining, if this lambda is time dependent, that's the only way how you get them. If it's time independent, you can also work with matrix exponentials. You can write them both explicitly, that's here, I'm going to skip that. I'm just going to make a remark that these Kolmogorov equations, of course, is an ODE system of the size of the state space. So if we have a large portfolio, we have 2 to the m states, and then they are not so useful, and we have to do something about that. I'm coming to that in a minute. The crucial part when you want to use this modeling approach is, of course, how you model this function lambda. That's your main input. And some examples. Jarrow and Yu use something which is called primary-secondary framework. They have two types of, split their whole portfolio into two types of firms, primary ones and secondary ones. Primary ones are not affected by the defaults of other firms, but they can affect the other ones. And secondary ones, on the other hand, they suffer if a primary firm defaults, but they do not, there's no circularity there. They do not inflict any harm on the primary ones. The economic interpretation for that is that primary firms could be something like big corporations, say General Motors, and the secondary one would be a main lender to a primary firm, which comes into trouble when the primary firm defaults and doesn't pay its credits back. We have thought something else. We have thought also to attack this size of the state space problem, we should maybe go to a homogeneous group model. And the simplest homogeneous group model with an entirely homogeneous model, which is what I'm going to present here, because with the group structure notation gets more messy. And there you say the default intensity of a firm should depend on time and the number of defaults in the portfolio. That would be the simplest way where you say, okay, there are two ways of justifying that. From an economic point of view, you might simply say, if I've seen already many defaults in my portfolio, it's quite likely that more are going to happen, either because the economy is in bad state or because banks might tighten credit lines because of the losses they already experienced. And so in case another firm comes into problems, it will probably also default because it doesn't get any new money, or might have many defaults, might have a negative overall impact on the business climate. On the other hand, when you simply say, I'm starting from this general model, but assume that it's exchangeable, you're going to automatically end up with something like that. So it's economically plausible on the one hand, but it's also sort of just exchangeability implies the structure on the other one. That's another paper of Yu, and there he has a specific example where I think he tried to explain default correlation and telecom bonds as a parametrization. Now the nice thing is, of course, that reduces the state space because M is itself a Markov chain and the generator is given here. That's quite logical. When you have L defaults, the only thing that can happen is that you're having L plus 1 defaults, And the intensity with that happens depends on the number of firms which are still alive. That is 1 minus L times the default intensity of the individual ones, which is given here. You can compute Kolmogorov equations there, and you can basically compute all quantities of interest of the original portfolio in terms of this M. So when you believe in a homogeneous portfolio and a homogeneous group structure, that's one possibility to reduce the state space and use analytic methods. Of course, when you want to resort to simulation, that's a strong point of this model. This Markov model is very easy to simulate. Recursively, you simulate the first default time, and then you know the new state of the portfolio, and then the second one. So that is no more complicated than in a model with independent defaults. Good. The following result is useful when you want to go to derivative prices. You can compute, for instance, the density of the default time, the probability that certain default density is given, that the density of the default time of a particular firm. And what you have to do is you basically have to sum over all firms such that they are still alive at time t, and then the intensity that default happens next instant times the probability that you are in that state. That gives you the density. Similarly, you can get conditional distribution of the default indicator conditional on the default time of a particular firm. And using combinatorial arguments, you can then get similar results for MT. And this here, for density of a particular default time in the homogeneous group model also. And with that, you can then attack credit derivatives. So very brief, maybe credit default swaps. What is that? I think everybody knows, probably. Still a brief repetition to make the notation clear. We have three parties involved, reference entity C, and then B and A, which really have the contract. So B is the protection seller, A is the protection buyer. A pays a premium to B at fixed dates until the default of the reference entity C or until maturity. If the default of C occurs, it makes a default payment to A. If the default of C does not occur in a particular time horizon from now until the maturity, there is no payment. So the next slide does this all once again in formulas. Premium payments at deterministic points and times, and that's a deterministic premium which has size some percentage point. It's annualized and times the time between the these deterministic time points. The default payment is typically loss related to the loss given default on some reference instrument. And the fair swap spread is then computed so that the value of both legs of the transaction is the same. A similar structure also exists at the so-called Cato default swap. It's all the same, just that the default is triggered by the credit, not by credit events in the portfolio. And in the case of the Cato default swap, default payment is being made if the Cato default time, capital TK, is before maturity. And the size depends on the identity psi k of the defaulting firm. Good. And maybe what we pricing, I'm not going to talk much about pricing results, how you can compute prices. We have done some work how you can compute prices or reduce pricing problems to something which you can compute with the Kolmogorov equations. I just comment on the ordinary credit default swaps maybe. The premium payments are terminal value claims of the form H is a function of the state of the portfolio at time TK, and G of Y is just the size of the payment times 1 minus Y, namely you have to pay only if the firm is still alive. That can be done if you want with the backward equation, and the price of the default payments is given here. Notation is here. P is the equivalent martingale measure here. Risk-free interest rate is R. And d of t x of minus integral from 0 to t r of s ds is the default free discount factor. And so if you use a martingale approach, this would be the price, the loss given default, times the discount factor up to discounting up to the random time where the default payment occurs, and payment occurs only if default happens before maturity, and by conditioning on, and you get that this is basically depends only on the distribution of this random default time tau I zero under p, and so we get this expression here, and we've just computed this density. Now you can do something a little bit more intelligent and do similar results with basket default swaps, but in the interest of time, I'd rather skip that and have a bit more time for CDOs, which are the most important portfolio credit derivatives. Anyhow, the basic structure of a CDO, we have sort of assets that can be for, we're mainly interested in a so-called synthetic CDOs. So there the assets would consist of a pool of credit default swaps, single name credit default swaps, as we just discussed. And to be precise, this would be protection seller positions. So for instance, it could be a bank who has a lot of protection seller positions and who puts them together and wants to securitize them. These protection seller positions generate premium income. So we have CDS premiums, and they flow into a so-called special purpose vehicle. That's a legal entity which is there to set up the whole thing. And then they are going to be redistributed, sold again to the market. And it is done using tranches of different liabilities, of different seniority. That is the one with the lowest seniority, middle seniority, and senior is the one with the highest seniority. That's the liabilities of the transaction. And the holders of this tranche are going to get some protection fee. Now, of course, here we're going to see in this pool of credit default swaps, we're going to see some defaults. And then the bank or whoever is the original owner of the CDS has to make default payments. And these default payments sort of are then paid by the special purpose vehicle, but of course the holders at the end, as these things are being sort of passed through, they are compensated by default payments which are being made of the CDO. So here if the default happens in this portfolio here, the owners of the liabilities are making default payments, and that is then passed through. The whole trick is, of course, that these things here are packaged differently than they are being packaged here. Otherwise, there would be no interest in the transaction. And the main idea is the following. It is done in such a way that sort of the first default payments are done by the holders of these tranches. Only if the loss gets over a certain threshold, the owners of these tranches have to pay. And only if it goes an even higher threshold, the owners of this one have to pay. So in this way, sort of, even if this is, say, has all rating of B, you can make it in such a way that the senior have maybe a double A and the mezzanine still have a B rating, whereas this equity piece is unrated and would have a very low credit quality. So a homogeneous portfolio here can be repackaged that most of these have a high credit quality and only few have a low one. Now, formally, the payoff of these tranches, we have in our portfolio of M loans, the nominal of each loan is NI, loss given default is delta I, and the default indicator process is YT as before. The cumulative loss of the portfolio at time T is LT, that's the sum of delta I loss NI YI, so that's the percentage loss given default times exposure is the actual loss, and that happens if default of this firm has happened. And now we have CDO tranches, K tranches characterized by attachment points, K0 up to KK, and that's smaller than the overall exposure. The notional at a certain time is given by a function of the overall loss, and the function is a put spread with these two attachment points. I'm going to show you a picture in a second. And in a stylized CDO, the payoff is just given by the value of the tranche at maturity. That is not what is really being traded, but it's good for thinking about CDOs in the first place. Now, I think it's best to come to the picture. Here we have sort of a stylized CDO. I think it was made on 1,000 firms. And here we have the cumulative loss, 0, 20, 40, and so forth. And each of these firms, of 1,000 firms, has an exposure of 1 and a loss given default of 0.5. Now here we see the first tranche, that would be the equity tranche, where there is just an attachment point of 0 and 20. So that would be sort of its payoff here, depending on the overall loss. Then we would have mezzanine tranche with lower attachment point of 20 and higher one of 40. That would be that payoff, and then it goes like that. And the senior one would be, again, this put spread like that. And superimposed, I have to show you intuitively how CDOs react to dependence between defaults. I have sort of two possible credit loss distributions. Both have the same mean. I think it's a default probability of 0.5. And with 1,000 firms, it is an average loss of 25. And these here are independent defaults. And then if you look, it's almost like standard. By central limit theorem, it's almost like a standard normal distribution with mean equal to 25. And this here would be then a distribution with the same mean, but with dependent defaults and the default, default correlation of maybe 2% or something, a realistic number. And we see that by introducing dependence between default, the mode of the distribution is shifted to the left, but we have a much heavier right tail. So for the dependent defaults, there's a substantial chance of losing more than 60, say. Now, if you look at what happens to the individual tranches, let's start with let's start with the senior tranche, where the payoff is given like that. Now, it is if you look with the equity tranche, it is quite unlikely that we're going to lose more than 40. So basically, here we're going to get all our money back. On the other hand, with dependent defaults, there's a substantial chance that we're going to have losses even higher than 60. So by introducing dependence, we make that one less valuable, if you want. Now let's look at this one here. We have the opposite effect. With independent defaults and low variance of the overall loss, it is quite unlikely that we're going to lose less than 20. So this year, the equity tranche will have a low value. On the other hand, when there is dependence, sort of because the mean is the same, the high losses which we have here, the possibility of having high losses sort of compensated by also having certain chance where scenarios with very few losses, so the equity tranche in turn will gain in value. And that carries over this intuition to the more realistic payoff structures which were actually being traded. This one. No, that is the independent one. If you have sort of independent defaults and then you take the overall losses as the sum of these independent ones, and that is then going to look more like a normal distribution if you have sum of independent random variables and sort of center more and more around. Well, that's just as it is, and we did this picture. Good. So the payment description of that's now a product which is actually traded. The attachment points are the same as before. The notional is the same as before. The tranches are the same as before. The cumulative loss of the tranche is just the amount of losses that fall within up to time t that fall within the layer, and that's given by n kappa of 0 minus n kappa of t. And the default payment of a tranche kappa at the end default time is given just by the part of the cumulative loss which falls in the layer, k kappa minus 1 k kappa, and mathematically it's just this here. And the protection fee, the holder of a tranche receives a periodic premium payments, and the premium payments at time t and are also proportional. This is some spread times the accruement period and times the notional. That's the important thing. So when you have a loss you have in the portfolio, you have to make a default payments when you're unlucky, and might also reduce the notional on which your spread income is computed, so it hits you both ways. And again, there are no initial payments, and this margin or a spread is adjusted so that sort of both parties are happy. Oh. Good. Okay, you can price this using partial integration, but again, that's not what I'm gonna focus on. What I would like to focus on a little bit is the is explaining market prices and the capability of certain models to do so. And that's sort of a game which is currently played in this literature. So by now there are even industries for credit default swaps, which are sort of the underlying of these CDOs. And you can also get prices for CDO tranches. So ITREX is one of these indices, a 5-year maturity of the swap. And as a specific example, we consider this here as on August 4, 2004. The numbers are taken from a paper by Hull and White. The average index level was 42 basis points, and if you assume a constant recovery rate of 40%, you get a marginal default probability under Q, under the risk neutral measure, which is here P, that's all risk neutral, of course, of 1 to the 1 minus e to the minus lambda t, and lambda is 0.7%. And the 5-year default probability is 3.4%, so that's quite high quality if you want portfolio. And then you have also observed prices for CDO tranches. This equity is quoted in a slightly different way, which need not interest us. And that's the attachment point 3 to 6% of the over portfolio, 6% to 9% and so forth. And that's the CDO spread in percentage terms. That's just as you could trade on that day on the market. And that is, however, typically not how one would represent these prices. One would try to represent them in terms of the parameter of this row of this Gaussian copula model, just as on option markets, one normally does not quote option prices but implied volatility. And there are two ways of doing that, both related to the correlation parameter of this Gauss copula model. And the one is the implied tranche correlation, and the other one is the implied base correlation. The implied tranche correlation is the value of rho in a homogeneous Gauss copula model that leads to these observed tranche prices. The problem with that is that it's not uniquely defined for the mezzanine tranches. I explained to you sort of why it's monotonous for the senior ones and for the equity ones. And in the middle, these two effects sort of counterbalance, and you have sort of one or two tranches where there is a problem. The implied base correlation is a clever way of practitioners to get over this problem. That's the value of rho, which explains of the equity tranche with the corresponding attachment point. In our example, that would be 0, 3, 0, 6, and so forth. And then that is uniquely defined, as I said, because for equity tranches, you have higher rho leads to lower prices. So there you have some monotonicity. And the clever way is that market practitioners have devised a way of sort of, because that is not what is traded on the market, when you see these CDO prices for 0, 3, 3, 6 and so forth, you can recursively get the price, the corresponding prices of these equity tranches, and from that you can get then the implied correlations. And these are called base correlations, and that is sort of a very popular quantity on this markets. To come to our previous example, these previous numbers, the tranche correlation would be given here, and that's this graph. That's a typical pattern. It is first decreasing and then increasing again, but here there is somewhere non-uniqueness. I think in this case here you have to make a choice which number you take. The base correlation would then look like that, and that is typically always increasing. That would be this thin blue line here. Now this is a typical pattern of tranche and base correlation, and it is called base correlation skew. And this basically means, has two implications. First of all, the simple Gauss model cannot explain all prices simultaneously. If you go further out in detail, if you want, you would have to market assumes higher and higher correlations. So if you want to explain, for instance, the price of this tranche very far out, you would have to assume higher correlations, of course, means that scenarios with more defaults become more likely. And so the market sort of, the further you go out with this model, the higher you have to make your correlation, because in a sense, the market assumes that scenarios with many simultaneous defaults are more likely than implied by this Gauss coupler model. It sits in the sense of not enough heavy tails. And now, also in these markets, one is interested in finding a single model that explains, say, at least approximately the prices of all these tranches and can reproduce the qualitative behavior of observed CDO prices. For instance, you need it when you want to price CDOs where the attachment points are not standard, but in between, or there are also CDOs of CDOs, and for that you would need one model that can explain all tranches simultaneously. And so we have been interested in seeing if our Markov model could sort of, when you use an appropriate parameterization, explain these prices somewhat better. And the idea is that this should work if you make an interaction between the intensities increasing and convex in the number of defaults. So that this convexity means that there can be sort of in the model, there can be real default cascades when you have go beyond a certain number of defaults. Then this has an interactive effect, making further defaults quite likely, so that there will be occasional rare large clusters of defaults. And for that, we use sort of parameterization, which is essentially exponential. We have some lambda zero, that's sort of the basic default intensity, which is multiplied here by some interactive term. And the important part is here that it's growing exponentially, and in L over M is the ratio of defaults which happened so far. It's basically growing exponentially here, but only above a certain threshold, which is the number of defaults you would expect there anyhow. So we have three parameters here, and we've tried to see if that works. The fact is, it works much better. The idea is that this parameter lambda 2, which governs the degree of convexity in this, and hence sort of the strength of the interactive effect, if we increase that, we should come closer to what the market prices are doing. So we increased that one and calibrated the other ones to default probabilities and the price of the equity tranche. Here are different parameter sets, so we increased that one and therefore increased sort of the degree of convexity in this function, in this interaction function for the intensity or the likelihood of extreme default scenarios. And then of course we had to sort of adjust the other ones. Those are the observed tranche prices, and those are the ones we're getting. And if you see, the further we go here, the closer we come. But we have to be honest, I think that's as good as it got, but it gets quite good. We can capture this is always the same, but here we're getting very close to the observed prices, and we have also the qualitative pattern matched quite closely. The nice thing is that you can have sort of also a tentative interpretation of the parameters. This lambda zero is responsible for the default probability. The product of these two is sort of responsible for the overall default correlation or the price of the equity tranche, because if you look at the product of these two numbers, it stays roughly the same. So it's 112 or something. And lambda 2 itself is responsible for the base correlations Q. I see Steve standing up, but fortunately I'm at the last slide now. And that is sort of, again, this base correlation as we get it from our model. That's the market data here. And that's these different curves, and that's as good as it got, sort of. I think we've been coming pretty close. And so the message, if you want, is that maybe by going away from these copulous models and looking at other models where you have a little bit more intuition as to what is going on in terms of interaction between defaults and default dependence, it might be possible to sort of explain or come closer to what markets are doing there. Okay, that's...
Questions? How do we make it consistent between portfolios, different portfolios which have some common name? You have ABC in the one portfolio and ABB in the second portfolio. When CD4 in your first portfolio affects the intensity of A and B, but not A and B in the other portfolio because C is not in your portfolio.
Well, that depends. Okay, the question was how to make it consistent across portfolios. And I think the basic question is sort of, if you have, say, a portfolio ABC and then whatever BCE, and default of A affects the default intensity of B in portfolio 1 but not in portfolio 2 if you use this model because it's not there. That is true. That depends on how you view the model. If you view it really, if you view this story as real interaction coming from business effects, then even if you are interested in pricing only A, B, C, but if you believe that there is some interaction between these and E, then you have to include E into your model, even if it is not, and you have to have a very large overall model. That is sort of true for all models that go beyond conditional independence. That would be also true in the Coppola model if you apply it consistently. On the other hand, if you view this more as an intuitive mechanism for generating default correlation, which you sort of understand, then you could just ignore that. But if you take the story serious, then you would have to sort of start with a world model for all firms where you believe that there is some interaction going on. Because, of course, it might always be the case that when you have A and B in the portfolio and sort of there is a circular dependence between A, B and some firm outside the portfolio, like A influences D and D influences B, then, of course, that has an impact on the default dependence between A and B, and in principle should be there if you believe it's important. Of course, it depends also on the size of these impacts. If you believe that it's really important, then you should include it. The only thing is, I can say to defend my model, at least it forces you to think about these things. When you just write down a copula, you forget that entirely.
So, other questions? One of the other disadvantages of the copula model, which you didn't mention, is that there's a time consistency issue, but it's really essentially a static model. And this looked a little bit more dynamic to me.
That is a dynamic model, and the model sort of, yeah, that is true. This is a dynamic model, a Coppola model, where you can make it a dynamic model. You can look at the implied default intensities and all of that in a Coppola model. But then, as soon as you know, if you use it, say, time t equals 1, not, say, if you start with a Gaussian Coppola, you calibrate the whole stuff, and then at time t equals 1, what a practitioner would do, he would again use a Gaussian coupler and calibrate it to different parameters. If instead he'd use the conditional distribution, say, of under the Gauss coupler fitted at time 0 of his surviving firms given the default history, he would end up with a model which is outside a Gauss coupler. I think the only one which is consistent is a so-called Archimedean copulas, which are gamma mixtures of exponentials. There you stay at least within the same class. And then all the advantages of copula models would be gone, because then all of a sudden under this conditional distribution you can no longer separate marginals and the rest. So in a sense these copula models are ignoring this dynamic consistency issues completely. It's a recalibration at every point in time. So that's also important. I think as soon as one moves on to hedging, and so also these dynamic models are maybe advantages.
In pricing a CDO, the dynamics don't matter that much. For pricing other instruments like options, then it matters. Mm. But for pricing CDO, as long as you get the same term structure of spreads for all firms and the same dependence assumption, dynamics don't matter. You can assume stochastic intensities, but if you have different models that give you the same term structures, you will get the same prices for the CDO because you have the same exact probability of default at every point in time. Every firm, as long as you have the same dependence.
Well, it does matter a little bit because, of course, the timing of defaults does matter with CDOs. And so it's not only the distribution at the same point, at one given point in time that matters, but it also matters the distribution over time. But in a sense, you're right, but as soon as you sort of start to think about, which is sort of slowly starting, given that markets for credit default swaps are getting more and more liquid, to think about issues like hedging, then all of a sudden the dynamics do matter a lot, and these models would imply completely different hedging strategies.
So but I think we have time for one more.
Well, that was just elaborating on the last point. The deltas that you get when you hedge the tranches in the underlying CDS index are immensely sensitive to your model specification. So you may fit price as well, but your hedging policies depend critically on your model, and I think the dynamic models have a better way of approaching that issue.
Okay, so I'd like
to... That was more of a comment, really.
Actually, I think particularly because people are now trying to hedge spread movements, and so they do care about the hedging properties of the model, and so they do have to think about the dynamics.
Yeah, but it is sort of true when you look at the early literature on portfolio credit derivatives. It seems a little bit like people have, in this part of the literature, forgotten what we've learned in mathematical finance overall, and there's a lot of rediscovering it now. It's all just distribution and just pricing and no... I mean, of course, one could also start to worry about things like market completeness and these things here. It's probably so hopeless that nobody ever tried. But it's not even, very often it's not even mentioned in this literature.
So I would like to thank Rüdiger again.